Welcome aboard the Ship Shape Podcast, your ultimate destination for marine wisdom and expertise. Our skilled crew, comprised of top boating journalists and experts, is committed to delivering informative and captivating content week after week. We're eager to connect with and learn from our fellow mariners, and we encourage you to share our podcast with your friends. Remember, word of mouth is our lifeblood. And if you enjoy an episode, please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. By doing so, you're helping us forge a robust community of mariners who can learn, collaborate, and exchange their experiences out on the water.
Today on the Ship Shape Podcast, we have Brian Beckham, a trial lawyer, computer scientist, philosopher, based in Houston, Texas. He is a partner at VB Attorneys, which has obtained hundreds of millions of dollars for their clients and have been in some of the most famous cases, including Captain Phillips. Brian has been voted Texas Super Lawyer multiple times. In addition to this phenomenal legal career, Brian is also the host of the podcast Lessons from Leaders. Your two co-hosts today are Meryl Charette. I'm a live aboard on a Ta-Shing Toshiba 36 in Boston, Massachusetts, and Farah.
Hi, my name's Farah, and I'm a radio and podcast presenter for the last 20 years.
So, Brian, where are you coming to us from?
I'm coming to you from Houston, Texas. Meryl, I thought you were supposed to say you're from Boston. I thought people from Boston, you're supposed to pronounce Boston. I'm from Boston. No, I'm in Houston, Texas. That's where I've called home for about 25 years now.
Well, I'm very envious that you call it home because you probably have lovely weather compared to us at the moment.
It depends on when you ask. In July and August, it is like India. It's so hot and humid, you can almost not go outside. But the other 10 months of the year are really, really nice.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we play golf year round.
Oh, no, I could take that any day compared to the rain that I'm dealing with right now outside.
Yeah, sure.
No, thank you so much for coming on board, Brian. We're really excited to have you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So, Brian, can you tell us this journey from going to school, being an athlete, computer scientist, to becoming one of the more famous lawyers in Texas?
Yeah, sure. It's a little bit convoluted, but I'll tell it in the most efficient way I can tell it. So when I was very young, my mom was diagnosed with terminal breast cancer. My dad was in the United States Air Force at the time, and she had been misdiagnosed over the course of 2 years, five separate times. The thing about it was that she was a nurse. This is in the early 80s. And so she did self-examination. She knew how to do that. And back in the late 70s, early 80s, that wasn't quite as widespread. But she had detected something. She'd been to the doctor over the course of 2 years, five times. They had misdiagnosed it five times. Finally got a terminal diagnosis, lived 5 years, and died when I was 10 and my brother was 8. My dad, I didn't know it at the time, but my dad hired a lawyer to sue the United States government for medical malpractice and won the case. And that case ended up enabling me and my little brother to go to college and to go to law school, because my dad, like I said, was in the military and didn't make a lot of money. You can actually Google that case, Beckham versus the United States. I found out about that case, believe it or not, when I was in law school. And the way I found out about that case is my now wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, was also in law school with me, called me up at work and she was crying. And she said, "I just read your mom's case." And I said, "What case?" And she said, "The case that your dad did. It's online." And I pulled it up and I read it. You can Google right now, Beckham versus United States, and it's online. But anyway, it was an experience. It was almost like talking to my mother again, 15 years after the fact, I guess it was. So I think subconsciously, that experience kind of drove me, at least once I got involved in the legal industry, towards representing families and people that had suffered catastrophes of some sort, whether they've been horribly injured or that somebody's died, lost a family member. And the other thing that really pushed me in that direction as a lawyer was, I tell this story all the time, when I went to college, I have no lawyers in my family on either side as far back as I can trace. I'm the only lawyer. So being a lawyer was not on my mind going to college. What was on my mind when I went to college, I went to a school called Texas A&M, was playing basketball. And so I went down there and I was an athlete. I was a jock. I mean, I was a smart kid, but the school was not my first priority. Played basketball. And this is in the early 90s. when the internet had just came out. I had an email address, but of course it was not very useful because you couldn't email anybody because nobody else had an email address to send anything to. But I kind of like computers. So I was like, you know what? I'll just study computer science. And so I tell people I spent 4 years in college behind a computer screen with a bunch of nerds. I decided I didn't want to do that. And so I went to law school. And now what do? 25 years later, I sit behind a computer screen all day long. So, but anyway, it was kind of a roundabout path. Anyway, I went to law school, did very well, ended up getting the way it works in law school in the United States, at least, is if you do well, then you clerk at the big firms and you get job offers from these big law firms or from the United States prosecutor's office or something like that. So I kind of did the route everybody expected you to do. I went to a very big law firm. At the time, it was the biggest law firm in Texas, a firm called Fulbright Jaworski. And I figured out after about 2 years that representing insurance companies and big corporations was just not for me. And so now, 22 years later, here I sit.
How soon did you figure that out? I mean, because, you know, you said it was kind of ingrained in you after your mother's situation and what she went through. You felt that it was your calling to help people who've been through traumatic situations or dealt with negligence. So how soon did you realize that that was your calling?
I will tell you the exact moment that I realized that that was my calling. So I was a very young lawyer and I was defending an insurance company. And it was a case where a young black guy, he was in his 20s, had fallen off a roof at work. He was working as a plumber. He was up on a roof. He fell down. He hurt himself. And I represented the insurance company. And I lost badly. And wow. I remember sitting across the table from this guy and his lawyer and handing him the check that he had won and thinking to myself, man, I really like this guy. I'm glad he's getting this money. And I thought to myself, I'm like, I'm probably on the wrong side of this equation because I literally just got my teeth kicked in. I lost so bad. And I'm happy about it, you know. I was like, and then this guy, this check, thinking, man, this guy really deserves this. So I was like, I'm on the wrong side of this thing. It was literally within 4 or 5 months that I was gone and doing something else.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Yeah.
And as we kind of move into your career and in kind of Marine, how exactly did you end up in Marine?
So I went to, again, just kind of pure luck, really, to be honest with you. I go to law school at University of Texas, and there's a law professor by the name of David Robertson, who's now deceased. But David Robertson, everybody told me, they're like, this guy's the best teacher in terms of just being entertaining and teaching you the material. Go take his class. What's his class? Admiralty law. What? Admiralty law. Okay. Never heard of it, but I'll go take it. Well, he was a phenomenal teacher. And admiralty law, I mean, when you go from spending an hour in a contracts class, you know, clause number 2B78. I mean, Meryl, you went to law school. You know what I'm talking about.
I did a year of law as well. I feel your
pain. So you know what I'm talking about. Like you're reading about, you know, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, contract law, and then all of a sudden you shift over to a piracy case on the high seas from the 1820s. It's like
riveting.
The ladders, it's just riveting. It's so much more
interesting. Yeah. It's like me with criminal law and land law. I nearly died at land law. I was like, oh my God.
Exactly. Yeah. We call that property law in the United States. And there's something called the rule of perpetuities that everybody jokes about all the time. But yeah, in any event, I took this class. It was super interesting. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to go do this big law thing. No plans at all to be a maritime lawyer. And when I started my own firm, I got a couple of these little maritime cases in Houston. We're right next to the Gulf of Mexico. There's a lot of oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. And so there's a lot of people on these drilling rigs, and these drilling rigs are very dangerous. So a lot of people get hurt. And so I started representing a lot of these, mainly guys. There are some women out there, but not a lot. And I just really enjoyed it. So again, just kind of almost happenstance in a way. But, you know, I look back and Meryl, you may relate to this a little bit. You know, I've always been really interested in particularly British naval history, like the Patrick O'Brien books, the Hornblower books, the Age of Sail. All of those kind of stories have always absolutely fascinated me from a very young age. Even though it was happenstance that I got into maritime law, it kind of jives a lot with my interests. And in addition to that, I'm also a fisherman. So fishermen love the water. It just kind of fits with my interest, I guess, is the best way to put it.
So as we get into the meat of the events in Captain Phillips, could you give us the play-by-play of the event? What actually happened?
That depends on who you listen to. Do you want to know the Hollywood version, or do you want to know what actually happened?
What actually happened?
Yeah, so what actually happened was, and we didn't learn about this until after I got the case, and that's a whole nother story that your listeners might be interested in, that I can talk about in a little bit, but here's what happened. There had been, at the time, a lot of piracy attacks off the coast of mainly Somalia, East Africa, and it was becoming something of a problem. And, you know, one of the things that I learned during this case that a lot of people may not know is when you talk about piracy, the pirates in East Africa are fishermen and they're teenage Somalis, and it's basically a business, and that's how they make money. So we're not talking about heavily armed pirates. We're talking about basically, by and large, kids or teenagers in these small little fishing boats that take advantage of ships that they can get to. And so there was all these warnings at the time from all these different maritime agencies, stay 200 nautical miles off the coast of Somalia. If you do that, the pirate, they don't even have the capability to get out further than that. So you'd be safe.
Of that radius, well, basically.
Yeah, that radius was a protective radius. There was all sorts of advice. And none of these ships, by the way, have any sort of defensive weaponry. So no firearms, no knives. There was some, if you saw the movie Captain Phillips, there's these big water cannons being shot off. The vessel, by the way, was called the Maersk Alabama. Mm-hmm. All these water cannons and stuff, they didn't have any of that. That's all made up in the movie. So they're totally unarmed. And it's an American merchant ship, which is a big juicy target. And they decided to take a shortcut, was the bottom line. They decided, they were told not to go within 200 nautical miles. And Captain Phillips just ignored that advice, went twice as close as he was supposed to, and basically invited these pirates to attack the ship. And that's exactly what they did. I took Captain Phillips' deposition over 2 days during this case. And I can tell you that Captain Phillips is an idiot by and large. Like, Tom Hanks did a great job portraying a boat captain, but the boat captain he portrayed was not Captain Phillips. Like, that's nothing like the guy. The guy's just kind of a little bit of a nincompoop. At least he was about this case. And I tell you what, I ended up getting the case. So the crew of the ship was the one that fought off the pirates, basically. Captain Phillips didn't do anything. Like, when you see in the movie Captain Phillips offering himself up to be taken by the pirates, that's complete nonsense. That never happened. What actually happened was the unarmed crew got spoons. Some of my clients got spoons and were using them to basically stab the pirates. Matter of fact, one of the pirates, if you saw the one surviving pirate, there were four of them. Three of them got killed by the Navy SEALs. One of them got stabbed in the eye with a spoon by my client. So when he was being perp walked, he has an eye patch on, and that's from a spoon injury. But anyway, my guys were real heroic, and they get back to the United States and they get with Captain Phillips and they say, let's tell a story about this. Like, let's write a book about our experience. And Captain Phillips said, screw you guys. I don't want to do anything with you guys. I'm going to do it myself. And so they were like, okay, well, in that case, screw you. You know. So they originally wanted to tell the story together, but Captain Phillips didn't want to do that. So I get a call from the galley hand, one of the galley hands on the vessel. And by the way, this is long before anybody knew there was going to be a movie. Hey, do you want to represent me? I was like, yeah, sure. Next thing you know, I got basically all the crew. So I was a lawyer for the crew, and the defendant in the case was the shipping company, Maersk Alabama, and the staffing company that staffed Captain Phillips, a company called Waterman Steamship. So that's kind of how that all played out.
How many members of crew were you talking about when you say you're representing?
There were 24 total crew, if I'm remembering correctly, and I represented half of them.
That's excellent.
Yeah. And I would have represented all of them, but some of them weren't U.S. citizens. And so you really don't have, at least under the Jones Act, which is the American Maritime Personal Injury Statute, foreigners have a hard time bringing cases under that statute.
So what were your initial sentiments when the case was brought to your table?
You know, I knew about the story was all over the news. So I knew about what happened. And, you know, the main thing in the, Meryl, I don't know if you remember it this way, but one of the big focus in the news media in the United States was the fact that the Navy SEALs came in and eliminated three of the four pirates. Like, that was a cool part of the story. Everybody's really interested in that. You know, Obama ordered them to go save these people. You know, that was really what my focus was more about when I get the first call on the case. But of course, as soon as a lawyer, one of the things that I take a lot of pride in is when I investigate a case, I do it very, very thoroughly. And as soon as we started looking into this case, it became apparent very, very quickly that Maersk and Captain Phillips had made some really bad decisions. And they had made those decisions on purpose. And they made those decisions for a very specific reason, and that was to save money. Basically, they were trying to take a shortcut to save money on fuel. So that became obvious really, really quickly. And the fight ultimately ended up being about what information I was allowed to look at and what information they were allowed to hide. Because when you go overseas, there's all sorts of regulations, particularly you have to have something called a vessel security plan. And they wouldn't let me see that. There was a bunch of other, and there's also, I can just tell you, there's a lot of stuff that I'm still under a confidentiality order that I can't talk about. But there was all these interesting rumors about what happened. So, for instance, I'll give you one interesting rumor. The ship carried $30,000 roughly in cash, just as a matter of course. And nobody ever found it. We have no idea what happened to that money. There's some suspicions, and there was rumors that some of the Navy SEALs took it. And there was investigation. I think there was a DOD investigation. Nothing ever came of that, but... Where'd it go? So that was a little interesting piece of the deal. The other thing that was interesting is, as I'm sure you both can imagine, the birth records in Somalia are not very reliable. And so the one surviving pirate who's in federal prison right now, being charged, I think he got convicted of piracy. It was the first piracy conviction in over 100 years. But they didn't know for sure whether he was an adult or not. They still don't. Like, he could have been 16, he could have been 22. They just have no records at all to prove how old he was. So,
goodness.
Yeah, that was another interesting part of the case. But there was all these little, you know, little weird things that went on that was like, you know, the money's gone. Why are we so close to the shore? Like, what are we doing here? I mean, we've been told not to do this. Like, why? What's motivating this? So, but anyway, and then the movie came out. That's when I started getting phone calls from the London Daily Times and the New York Times and Nightline and Dateline and all these people. What do you think about this? And I'm like, well, I thought Forrest Gump was a great movie as well, but it's all made up, just like this movie. It's all made up. So basically, the only thing about in that movie that actually happened was the pirates attacked an American ship. All the details are what's the best word? Yeah, they're just they're exactly they're embellished a little bit, which is fine. That's that's what you got to do to tell a good story. So
absolutely,
yeah.
And what ended up being the conclusion of this lawsuit?
They settled with every single one of my clients for a confidential amount. And there is a reason it's confidential.
Let's just say they walked away happy.
I will say it was an incredibly hard fought case. So the case, I originally filed the case in Houston, Texas. It went up to the Texas Supreme Court twice. Then it was in Virginia and Alabama and Texas all at one time. Then there was a case against Maersk in Virginia, a case against Waterman Steamship in Alabama. Ultimately, the whole case got kind of consolidated into Alabama. But it took 4 or 5 years. It was a lot of work. But I will say this, I'm really proud of the fact that, at least to my knowledge, there has not been another substantial pirate attack off the coast of East Africa since that case. And the reason, there's a real specific reason for that. They now arm the vessels. And again, you got to keep in mind, these are fishermen primarily. And the second they see a weapon of any kind, they go onto the next ship. They're looking for the biggest targets that are the softest targets is what they're looking for. Contrast that, by the way, with another pirate case I had off the coast of West Africa, where an American ship captain got kidnapped by Boko Haram and taken into the jungles of West Africa for 18 days, and basically tortured for 18 days. Those are sophisticated former military mercenaries with weapons and stuff. That's a whole different ballgame. In any event, there hasn't been, at least to my knowledge, I hadn't checked this in a few years, another pirate attack since my lawsuit. And that's because the shipping companies are taking what I think are extremely reasonable steps making sure they don't go too close to shore, and making sure that the men and women on these vessels have some way to defend themselves. Mm. So I'm real happy about that.
Which they previously didn't, right?
That's right. And I'll tell you why. So when I got the case, one of the first things I was wanting to know is, you know, you got all these pirates in East Africa. Why don't you allow them to arm themselves, allow the ships to at least carry some weaponry to defend themselves? And you know what the answer I got was? The insurance companies don't want them to do that because they're afraid they're going to shoot each other. Mm. they're not trained well enough, or they're going to shoot something on the boat and like blow it up, and they're going to ruin all the cargo. So they just basically didn't trust the, you know, the average merchant mariner. And now that they got their, the you know what suit out of them by me, they've changed their tune a little bit.
So can I ask you that when you handed the 12 members of crew that you represented their check, did you feel that inherent satisfaction you felt when you were handing the check to the guy that when you realized you were on the wrong side?
The thing I like the most about what I do is not giving my clients the money. That's probably number two. The thing I like the most is when I hear from them years later and they tell me they've done something good with their settlement money. Because all too often, people get a big chunk of money and they blow it on something, and 5 years later, there's none left. But when I get a call from a client who's bought a house or invested in some apartment complex or went to school or has graduated, you know, like I've represented, you know, kids that are now lawyers and they've used their settlement money to go to college and law school. That's what's really rewarding for me.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Now, when we start talking about these Somali pirates, and you know, you describe them as fishermen, but it's also like a business. How did piracy evolve in Somalia to get to the point where something like this happened?
Yeah, that's a long story, and I'm probably not the best person to talk about it. But at the fundamental level, at least at the time, Somalia was just a complete, just a failed state. I mean, there's just no other way to put it. There's no way for any of these folks to make any money that's not criminal, I guess, in some respects. So, you know, I'm one of these people that I kind of try to have the mentality there, but for the grace of God go I. And if I was in Somalia and I was a teenager and all my buddies were getting on ships and going out and making money by taking money off of undefended commercial ships, I don't know if I wouldn't do the same thing. They realized, Merrill, that the ships were just super soft targets. I mean, they just were. At one point, they started having military convoys, and they would have the ships, the commercial ships in a convoy, traverse the most dangerous parts at the same time. But that was long after the piracy had kind of really matured in the area. And so for a very long time, it was just, I mean, just easy money, right? I mean, just it's just not hard. So
especially when there's very little resistance as well. I mean, given the fact that there was no weapons and that, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly.
There's very little resistance.
That's exactly right. And there was a period of time where they would kidnap people on the vessels too, and they would ransom them after they kidnapped them. I think that comes when you start talking about kidnapping citizens of other countries and their governments and military start getting involved. That raises the stakes quite a bit. Yeah. So I think they rightly try to avoid something that's going to get the United States Navy SEALs involved, you know, or, you know, the British Special Forces involved, that they want to fly under that radar. But again, Merrill, I think it's just like a lot of things. When people are desperate, they do desperate things, you know?
So looking back on this whole case, what do you think the most significant takeaways for the marine industry and the broader international community are?
Probably the most significant thing to me was that there hadn't been a piracy lawsuit in a century. And I don't think the shipping companies, the way the shipping industry works, generally speaking, and this is, by the way, this is pretty big generalization. So I want to say that before I say what I'm about to say, but generally speaking, the way the shipping industry works and has for hundreds of years is it's based in Great Britain primarily. Now there's some places in Asia where there's a huge shipping operation, but all the shipping companies, and more importantly, the insurance companies that insure these huge commercial ships are mainly based in London. Matter of fact, Lloyd's of London is kind of the original shipping insurance company. I don't know if you guys know the story behind Lloyd's of London, but basically I think it was in the 1600s. Lloyd's of London was a coffee shop, and rich people would get there, and it was by the harbor, and these ships would go off and that nobody would hear from them for 2 years. I mean, then there was no way to communicate. There was nobody knew. And so these rich people would start essentially making bets on which ships were going to come back. And that turned into the Lloyd's of London insurance market. In any event, the insurance companies and the Lloyd's of London's of the world, they run the show. I mean, they decide what you can get away with and what you can't. And I think before the lawsuit, Meryl, they didn't think you'd get sued for piracy. There hadn't been a successful lawsuit for piracy in ever, as far as I know, civilly. And this changed the stakes. I mean, when I filed a lawsuit, when you file a lawsuit in the United States, you have to lay out what your claims are. And one of my claims said they didn't have any weapons to defend themselves with. The insurance companies went crazy. They thought I was insane. They're like, what are you talking about? You're going to give these guys guns? That's the most dangerous thing I've ever heard. This is crazy. We're going to raise everybody's rates. Well, 2 years later, that's what everybody does now. So I was right and they were wrong. And so I think probably the biggest thing it's changed the perspective in the insurance markets about what is reasonable and what is not reasonable. And these insurance companies now know that if they send people into, or they send ships into areas where there's piracy and they don't have a way to defend themselves, they're going to get sued and they're going to lose. So they know that now. So what does that mean? That means all these mariners are safer because now they're not going to dangerous places without adequate protection. So I think that is the biggest. Piracy is still a problem. I'm not saying it's eradicated, but it's way better now than it was 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Ahoy, investors. Are you on the lookout for a unique opportunity to invest in a thriving industry? Set your sights on ShipShape, the innovative platform connecting boat and yacht owners with top-notch marine service providers. Our team is committed to revolutionizing the marine repair and refit market in North America. But we can't sail these seas alone. With your support, we can enhance our platform and create a significant impact in the industry. Don't let this exciting investment opportunity drift away. Contact us today to learn more about joining our voyage. Reach out to us at info@shipshape.pro.
How do you think the story of the hijacking and the lawsuit has been influenced by public opinion on the issues of piracy and maritime security?
Yeah, so remember, when I got this case, I had no idea there was going to be a movie. I had no idea Tom Hanks would be in the movie. None of that. And it was about halfway through the case where we found out there was going to be a movie and Tom Hanks was going to star in the movie. And you know what the first thing I did when I found that out was? I went to the court and I said, Judge, we need to go to court now. Because if we wait until this movie comes, Tom Hanks, the most popular actor in America, and if we wait till this movie comes out, all the jurors are going to think Tom Hanks is a big hero and it's going to completely prejudice my clients. And the insurance company lawyers, no. We don't need to speed this up. We'll make sure the jurors are, you know, adequately questioned where they're not biased. Da, 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 da. And the judge was like, okay, we're not going to speed this up. So the movie comes out literally in the middle of the case. Tom Hanks is a star. Yeah. But guess what? Brian Beckham, a VB attorney, starts getting called by Nightline, Dateline, Good Morning America. I got millions of dollars of free marketing. And I won the case. So, you know, I tell people, I'm like, probably the best thing about that case was when the judge denied my request to speed the case up and made us wait until after the movie, because that's what made it famous. You know, it wasn't the case itself. It was the fact that it was Tom Hanks starring in the movie. And they had the Hollywood publicity machine behind it as well. And it also led to, right after the case was over with, a former U.S. Marine boat captain got kidnapped, like I was telling you guys, by Boko Haram. And guess who he called once he got free? He called me because he knew about the Captain Phillips case. So it enabled me to get my name out there. But anyway, you know, it's one of those things where sometimes you ask for something and you don't get what you want. It turns out to be better than it would have been had you got what you asked for to begin with. You know,
it works out.
Yeah.
So can you tell us, Brian, are there any lessons from the Maersk Alabama incident that can be applied to other security threats faced by the shipping industry, such as cyber attacks or terrorism?
Yeah, that's a great question. Traditionally, one of the things that was different about ships as opposed to land-based transportation is when the ships went away, you just literally, like we were talking about earlier, literally had no idea where they were, what they were doing, didn't know when they were going to be back, didn't know where they're ever going to come back. And now the communication is instantaneous. And so let me give you a little example of this. There's a special rule in maritime law in the United States where if somebody gets hurt on a vessel, then the vessel owner can sue the person that got hurt and say, you can only recover up to the value of the vessel and its contents. Okay. And so here's an example of that. When the Titanic sank and hundreds of people lost their lives, they were limited to the value of the Titanic as it was in the bottom of the ocean, right? Which, so the value is essentially nothing. And they were limited. You couldn't recover anything. It's called a limitation of liability proceeding. It's unique to maritime law. The reason there's a limitation of liability proceeding is because 200 years ago, when a ship went off to sea, there was no way for the owners to know what was going on. So how can you hold them responsible for decisions that are made that they don't even know about? So that was a reasonable law 200 years ago, but now at the time, they know instantaneously. They know immediately what's happening. And so there's really no excuse for the owners if the ship does something that's unreasonable. So it's like cyber crime. That's a good example. And that's actually, you know, as with a computer science degree, I'm super interested in that kind of thing. And at the end of the day, Farah, the important thing is that the owners are reasonable. Like if they know that there's a threat of cyber crime, you take reasonable steps to protect against it. So if you have computer systems that don't have antivirus software installed of some sort, that's not reasonable, right? You have redundant systems, which is another kind of just basic engineering and safety. So you don't want to have one system fails, everything else is toast. You have to have redundant systems. So at the end of the day, though, it's really just about being reasonable, just doing the reasonable thing. So like, is it reasonable when you're told not to go inside 200 nautical miles off the coast of Somalia to go twice as close? Is that reasonable? Of course not.
It's ever evolving, isn't it? I mean, like you just said, some of the laws were archaic now. What was archaic? Because at that time, they'd go away on a boat. You wouldn't know what's really going on. But now you know exactly what's going on. So, I mean, some of these laws are archaic. Do you feel it's constantly evolving as an industry? And do you feel there are times where the evolution, you're not able to keep up with how much is changing and how quickly it's changing, given the current climate that we're in?
That's a great question. That is absolutely, as we grow older, and something that takes effort. Like I have to work to stay on the cutting edge of ChatGPT. But guess what? I'm reading about ChatGPT. You know, that's just one example. And it's the same thing with the shipping industry. Like, things move and things move fast. But if you're going to be in the industry, you need to be on top of these things. And it takes some time and it takes some effort. And it might even cost a little bit of money. But that's what a responsible ship owner does. That's a responsible lawyer stays on top of the law. A responsible ship owner stays on top of shipping technology and stuff like that. A responsible news anchor stays on top of what's important in her profession or his profession. So it is a little more difficult and it is a little bit more work, but that's what responsible people do.
So what do you attribute to your success as a lawyer? And, you know, what advice would you give an aspiring lawyer in this field?
Yeah. That's actually fair. That's a joke. A lot of lawyers, here's my advice to my kids. Don't become a lawyer.
Tell me, go. I know. I used to hear that.
Yeah, tell them not to do this. Yeah. So, and I get that where that sentiment comes from, but I actually think a legal education is a great general education in terms of teaching you how to think a certain way. And I think that's valuable. I don't care what you do. So what I would tell somebody interested in the law is, I would say, I think it's a great education. And I don't frankly care whether you want to be a lawyer or not. I think it's just a great way to train your brain. So when I went to law school, I didn't tell you guys this, but when I went to law school, I was getting all these recruiting letters from patent law firms because of my computer science background. And so there was all these firms in Silicon Valley that were trying to hire me to be a patent lawyer. And I just didn't want to do that. And so I changed my mind. And then I thought I wanted to be a prosecutor for a little bit. So I changed my mind two or three times. So don't worry, try different things and you go to law school. But if you don't like to read and you don't like to write, don't go to law school, because that's basically all you do. I love to read. I love to write. And so it was just, when I went to law school, I was like, wait a second, I get to read all day long. Yes, I'm so excited. You know? But if that's not something you like to do, then law school is definitely not the place for you. But But I think the law is a great profession. And I think with all its problems, I think it's a noble pursuit. I think there's been some things, not to get into the politics too much, but the thing I was so proud about in the most recent presidential election was how the judicial system in the United States did its job. And you know what? The legislative and the executive branches, they're not doing their jobs right now, in my opinion. But the judicial system, by and large, again, it's not perfect, but by and large, I think it does a pretty dang good job of getting it right most of the time.
And as we kind of wrap this up, can you talk about your podcast, Lessons from Leaders?
Yeah, so I started this podcast in the United States and Texas. Quarantine lasted about 4 or 5 months. And so I was literally in my house with my kids and my wife 24/7, except once a day, my God, get something to eat for the family. But we took it real serious. So I'm sitting around like a lot of people were, with nothing to do, on the online all the time. Everybody's complaining. It's all negative. Everybody's yelling at each other. And I'm like, man, I want to get some positivity out there. This is all negative nonsense. And I happen to know a lot of really interesting people just from living my life. And so my wife and I are sitting out on the back porch one night. I'm drinking a glass of wine. What should I call it? She goes, how about Lessons from Leaders? And I was like, bingo, that's awesome. And you know why it's awesome, guys? Because if I say, you want to be on Brian Beckham's podcast? Some people be like, oh yeah. Some people, yeah. If I say, do you want to be on a leadership podcast? Everybody says yes. So, but anyway, I started this podcast from my house during the middle of quarantine called Lessons from Leaders. And I just wanted to focus on, frankly, people like you, like positive people that are doing positive things in the world, because I just didn't think there was as much of that as there should be. And, you know, it's been, I think I'm going on 100 guests now. I've had U.S. congressmen, military generals, Hall of Fame sports stars, news people, New York Times bestselling authors, all different sorts of people from all different sorts of walks of life. And it's been a real treat. It's been a real pleasure.
I can imagine you're basically radiating positivity. I mean, the give back on that is insane.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. Yeah, same to you. Same to you.
So can I ask, I mean, to the podcast, Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioner, golfer, yeah. Fly fisherman, yeah. Avid reader, yeah. Lawyer, yeah. Dad, and husband. Where do you get the time? There are only 24 hours in a day, Brian.
Yeah, no, when you... Well, it's so funny you'd say that, because when you put it the way you put it, I'm like, how, seriously, how do I find out? I'm actually just finishing Ulysses by James Joyce. I have one chapter left to go, and I don't know anybody who's not lying who's actually read the book cover to cover. So that's been my latest project. But I guess when you put it the way you put it, it seems like a lot. But to me, it's just living my life. I mean, I just enjoy all those things. So like when I go to Brazilian jiu-jitsu, it's not a struggle because I love doing it. I love the people I do it with. When I go out and play golf, I'm playing with my really good friends out in nature in the sun. And I really enjoy that. I got three wonderful kids and I like spending time with them. Fishing to me is like, fishing is like an active meditation. So I'm out there and they call it the fisherman's trance. Meryl, you may have heard that phrase before, but literally you'll be out there fishing and then you'll be look around and 3 hours has passed and you're like, whoa, that was awesome. You know?
So, and that's yeah, serenity on the water. That's the one thing I think being on a boat, it's just the most amazing, wholesome feeling that you can't describe.
That's right.
I think sunrises, sunsets on a boat, it's unmatched. It's just unbelievable.
Not only do I agree with you on that, Farah, I would actually say there's something really deep evolutionarily in the human instincts. I think when you're around a fire, sitting around a fire, and when you're on the water, it's just like this feeling. I just have this feeling like of calmness and of relaxation. Yeah, it's therapeutic. And I agree with you 100% on that. But to answer your question on all those different things, I guess the way I kind of look at it is it's not really that hard if you like all that, if you like what you're doing. And yeah, there's some bad times in the law practice when I have difficult clients or difficult adversaries that aren't that fun. But by and large, I like what I do. So it just, it doesn't feel like it doesn't feel like work that much, to be honest with you. Yeah.
Awesome. So can you tell us where people can find you and you know, listen to your podcast?
Absolutely. So my law firm website is vbattorneys.com. That's V as in Victor, B as in Brian, attorneys, vbattorneys.com. I have my podcast website is brianbeckham.org. I've also got some photography and some writing on there. The name is a little bit unusual. It's B-E-C-K-C-O-M. It used to be, everybody's like, oh, Beckham, like David Beckham. And I'm like, maybe I am Irish and English primarily. And so maybe hundreds of years ago, but at some point it was changed to B-E-C-K-C-O-M. And so it's a little bit of a weird spelling, but brianbeckham.org. And then you can find me on all the different social medias under my name, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, all that stuff. So I'm out there, YouTube.
That's fantastic.
Awesome. Well, it was a great interview, Brian. A fascinating story and fascinating life.
No, we can't thank you enough.
I really appreciate it.
A pleasure, an absolute pleasure talking to you. I think we could talk for hours. So many questions and so much more to discuss. But it's honestly been a pleasure. And we look forward to more exciting things. You know, we'll definitely look at the podcast. And if there's anything interesting, we'll definitely be speaking again, I'm sure.
Love it. Love it. And if you guys know anybody who gets attacked by pirates, you know who to send them to.
We know where to come. Before Hollywood gets to it, that's for sure. Yeah.
Well, great to talk to you guys. Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode. And be sure to like, share, and subscribe to ShipShape.pro.